door, if it gets too loud in the back door, you can close that one, hopefully. Welcome to the seminar series for the Center for Collaborative Conservation. At the risk of being highly repetitive, if you're in the wrong place, please stay, because this is going to be a good one. Somebody's still new to that and still laughing. That's good. So this fall, our seminar series is focusing on indigenous peoples and conservation. And is this our last one? Or do we have
one more?
We have one more speaker, which
Dave.
Dave Bartecki from Village Earth will give the next seminar, and that will be on, excuse me,
2 weeks from today.
2 weeks from today. All right, after Thanksgiving. So we've had a great series this fall. And so it's my pleasure to get a chance to introduce our new Associate Director at the Center for Collaborative Conservation, Dr. Kim Skylander. I want you to notice the E after Sky in the spelling of her name. That often gets dropped out, just so you know. Kim comes from us from a really diverse background. In fact, when I read all of the things that she wrote here, I thought, wow, this person is an intellectual and practical traveler through different ways of thinking. So she started out as a wildlife biologist at Utah State University and then moved on to other great universities in the West. And luckily, she finally ended up with the best one in the West now. But then she went on to Montana, and then she went on to Idaho to get her PhD. And in that process, she kind of migrated from sort of a more biological focus on things to a more to the more inclusive people orientation toward natural resources. And so at the University of Idaho, I think I'm going to get this right, she was part of a group called Conservation Social Sciences, which was the former, like our Human Dimensions of Natural Resources in the Warner College, was formerly a Natural Resource and Recreation Department. After that, she kind of took a right-hand or left-hand turn and decided to go into teaching. And that's not really necessarily a right or left-hand turn, but she didn't stay on the line of, you know, a lot of folks continue on to academia and research. She worked for a good period of time in there, actually. This is all not sequential, my apologies. But in there, she worked for the Forest Service first as a, and let me just read all this journey, sort of starting as a wildlife biologist, then a public affairs specialist, then an assistant district ranger, then a tribal government liaison, and then a wilderness ranger, probably not in that order, but really, really different things. And then she went into teaching, and she taught for 8 years at the Sage Kootenai College on the Flathead Indian Reservation, teaching natural resources. And then for the last 7 or so years, she was at Wolf Ridge Environmental Education Center, pretty close, in Minnesota, being their executive director and doing everything from teaching, which you do at an education center, to fixing the pipes and all kinds of other things, raising lots of resources. So it's just our great pleasure to have her speak with us today. And she's got a long title, but The People's Way Project, How Traditional Ways of Knowing the Land Lead to the Creation of the Most Extensive Wildlife-Sensitive Highway in North America. Welcome, Kim. We're so glad
to have you. Thank you, Robin. Mm-hmm. Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. This is great. I chose this topic mainly because it's a combination of collaborative conservation, indigenous knowledge, and traditional science, if you will. But I have to say that I'm not an expert on this particular project. I just happen to be working at the preservation with the tribes during the implementation of this project. So this is actually more of kind of a case study, and actually I'm actually just going to tell you a story. It's actually the story of this project, and it has an interesting history to it. Is anyone here from Montana? Anyone here familiar with Flathead Reservation? Did you live up there?
No, I went to the biological station.
Oh,
the white
people. Oh, yeah. Okay, the fish. Okay, all right. Anybody been to the Flathead Reservation? A couple folks? Okay, great. So if you have anything to add, you're free to jump in anytime. So there you are. So I do have a really long title. I won't read it again. You can read that for yourself. What I'm going to do is start with background about the Flathead Indian Reservation, which is where the project takes place, tell you a little bit about that. Then I'll introduce the project and tell you what some of the challenges were and some of the solutions to it. So our project, our story, actually takes place on the Flathead Indian Reservation, which is between Missoula and Kalispell, Montana, if you've been over that way. There's 7 reservations in Montana, and they include the Blackfeet, the Rocky Boy, Fort Belknap, Fort Peck, Northern Cheyenne, and Crow. And the Flathead Reservation originally went down through Missoula into the Bitterroot Valley at the time of the Hell Gate Treaty of 1855. But like a lot of reservations, it was opened up to settlement and land allotments, so it became the size that it is today. Still pretty respectable, about 1,317,000 acres. And about half, a little more than half of this reservation is actually tribally owned. The rest of it is owned by private landowners, and there are some state and federal holdings as well, but the tribe is in the process of going up land as it becomes available. Can you all hear me right in the back? Okay, great. Currently, the reservation has a little less than 22,000 people on it. Roughly about a third of that are tribal members. And the three tribes that make up the Flathead Reservation are the Salish, the Kootenai, and the Wanderai. And the governing body is called the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribal Council. And they make a lot of the decisions along with the tribal elders and the cultural community. And this lady here in the lower right-hand corner is Agnes Kenwile, a wonderful elder. Unfortunately, the tribe's lost her a couple of years ago, but wonderful, fascinating woman, made the best buckskin in the world. She was in huge demand for weddings and her powwow regalia, an excellent feeder, as well as a keeper of the knowledge for the tribes. And I was fortunate enough to take a traditional hide tanning class from her, so I feel fortunate about that. And she had the most infectious laugh. She would start off kind of giggling like a little girl, and soon she'd have this big belly laugh, and nobody in the room could not laugh when this woman was there. She really interesting lady. So the Flathead Reservation has a lot of wonderful natural resources on it. The reservation goes up to about halfway to Flathead Lake. I'm not exactly sure why it doesn't cover the whole lake, but it goes up halfway through the lake. As the Flathead River and the Mission Mountains that you see there, the tribe manages the mountains up to the crest, and on the other side, the west side, on the eastern side, it's U.S. Forest Service land. And the Confederate Salish and Kootenai tribes were the first tribe to actually set aside a tribal wilderness. So Mission Mountain is a tribal wilderness on the tribe side, and also happens to be a wilderness on the Forest Service side. Very beautiful place through there. It also has the National Bison Range and Nine Fives National Wildlife Refuge. Both of these are currently managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service through a permanent easement with the tribe. The tribe would like to take over the National Bison Range, a little bit of contention there, but so far it's under the Fish and Wildlife Service. Oh, I have to digress a little. I have to tell you a little story here. When I first got the job at Salish Kootenai College, my roommate Tana was very excited. She liked to spend a lot of time in Flathead Lake and camp out there. And she said, oh, that's great. You're going to work for the tribe. You get to drive up Highway 93, and you get to go by the Bison Range, and you get to go by Evro, and you get to go by Nini Peepee, and then you get to go to Flathead Lake. And I looked at her and I said, wait, excuse me? And I said, I go by the Bison Range, and I go by Nini Peepee? And she said, yeah, Nini Peepee, the wildlife refuge. And I said, Tana, it's called Nine Pipe. And she looked at me in total horror, and she said, she said, for 8 years I've been calling it Nini Peepee because I wanted to respect the Salish and Kootenai, and I thought it was a Salish word, and I've been telling everybody it's the Nini Peepee Wildlife. So I still laugh when I drive up there and I see that sign. I'm like, man, I'm Nini Peepee. It's actually pronounced 9-5. So there are several major sources of income for the tribe. The major one is they get revenue from Kerr Dam, which is a large hydroelectric power dam on the Flathead River by Flathead Lake, which they currently lease to the Montana Power Company. Potomac is the resort casino by Polson, which is their, Potomac means where the water leaves the lake. It's also the Best Western Hotel if you ever get to Polson. It's a nice place to stay. S&K Holdings, electronics manufacturing firm. The tribes like to encourage the members to bring in non-polluting industry and to create their own businesses on the reservation. Salish Kootenai College, where I worked, of course. It's a community tribal, a community slash tribal college, Indian and non-Indian, about 1,000 students. Also get income from land leasing and selling timber. There's quite a bit of forestry. They have a large forestry department there. Seasonal agriculture and tourism. And tribal government and employment. So these living revenues. So now I have a little bit of background about the reservation and the tribe. And the People's Way Project, well, what is it? This is a project that reconstructed 53 miles of US Highway 93 to meet the safety and capacity needs of drivers while respecting tribal cultural, community, and environmental values. And the 53 miles of Highway 93 go through the reservation, but the actual highway is quite long. It starts in Arizona, goes all the way up to Canada. So the section that we're talking about is that section that goes through the Flathead Indian Reservation. And at the actual picture of the road on the left, you can see it's a two-lane highway, winds around, has a lot of forests involved with it. So the players in this story are the Confederate States of Indian Tribes, Montana Department of Transportation, and the Federal Highway Administration. And later on, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came into play. But the ones we're talking about today are those big three. And these are three governments. You have the tribal government, state government, the Montana Department of Transportation, and the federal government through the Federal Highway Administration. So, why reconstruct Highway 93? Well, it just happens to be Montana's most dangerous two-lane highway. And you can see a little bit of statistics down there. 95 and 99, 42 people were killed. 727 were injured just on this 53-mile stretch that goes to the reservation. And so what's causing that? Well, as you can see in the lovely reservation, it is a very big wildlife migration area. Grizzly bears, everything from moose, grizzly bear, whitetail, mule deer, migrate back and forth through the valley and hook up with other wildlife corridors. So there's a lot of wildlife vehicle collision accidents that happen. And also the design of the road itself. It's a two-lane highway, it has narrow shoulders, it only has three passing lanes, and when you're, it's the only road that goes up to Glacier National Park in that part of Montana, so when you're driving along, you have RVs and campers and things, and you're getting a little frustrated, people take chances on the pass. It also has a lot of access roads, frontage roads, people's driveways that come in, access to community businesses, which is dangerous because you're trying to pull out on the highway and it's hilly, it's curvy, has a lot of design issues with it. And I drove this road for 8 years, commuting from Missoula up to the reservation and back. And a lot of times people would pass me and I always read the bumper stickers and the most frequent one was this one. Pray for me, I drive 93. Another one was, I'm a Highway 93 road warrior. So I actually didn't have any trouble on this section of the highway. My section, my problem in 93 was, it's another story, sorry, but one day I was driving down Missoula South to Hamilton on the southern part of 93, and I was with a friend, they had a little Toyota Tercel, and this object was coming towards us in the middle of the highway quite fast. I couldn't really tell what it was, but I could see the people down the way were all bailing off the highway left and right. Their cars were going off in the ditches, and I said, out. And we got a little closer, and I could tell what it was. It was a plane making an emergency landing on the highway. It was coming right down the highway, and you know, you could see the cylinder part of the plane and the wing sort of silhouettes. And I drove over to the side, and he did take his wing right over the top of the car. The poor guy looked in there, and he's over there in the cockpit, which is like totally white, no panic. But he could stop and everything. So that was my only scary part with Highway 93. So, to fix these problems, in 1989, the Montana Department of Transportation and the Federal Highway Administration came up with a proposal and a plan. They wanted to expand US 93 on the reservation into a four-lane divided highway so they could fix some of the problems that I mentioned before with wider lanes, passing lanes, all those things. Because I wanted to engineer this road so I had the highest level of safety, provide for increased traffic that was coming, and also provide it at the lowest cost. That's what good engineers do. However, the tribe didn't really want anything to do with this plan. They were not in favor of a four-lane divided highway for several reasons. One being that it would accelerate non-tribal development. Remember I mentioned that roughly a little more than half of the reservation is owned by the tribe, and the rest is in private or state or federal. They felt that a four-lane would adversely affect the wildlife in the wetlands. They already had a two-lane running through there, bisecting the migration route, so just think of a four-lane. They figured people would be driving faster and wreck the habitat, so they weren't in favor of that. And also would damage tribal cultural and spiritual sacred sites, as well as erase parts of the tribal history that's etched into the landscape. The tribe has had the reservation for a long time, and everything in the landscape has meaning to them. So they didn't want more disturbance with that. The tribal elders tried to get across to the highway department that the road is a visitor and should respond and be respectful of the land and the spirit of the place. This is a hard concept for the highway department to wrap its head around. And spirit of place, in this context, mainly being a continuum of everything on the reservation that is seen and unseen, touched, felt, and traveled through. So all the parts of the landscape, the natural outcroppings, the sacred sites, everything had been embedded in tribal members' minds, either through experience for generations, or through coyote stories, and coyote serves as a link between the tribal members and the natural and spiritual worlds of this highway was cutting right through. So, because there was a lack of vision, and there's quite a bit of lack of trust between the governments, there was a stalemate. They didn't really understand each other very well, so for 10 years this project was sort of put on the shelf, so to speak, because they could not agree on lane configurations, designs, environmental impacts, or the enhancements there. A lot of different reasons. And most of it was trust, like I said, lack of common vision and different values. So eventually, what really happened is the highway department actually tended to see the tribe as this. A little bit secretive, hard to catch, elusive, you know, they didn't really understand them. Where the tribe tended to view the highway department as this. Rather puffed up, had its own way of doing things. They were the engineers, they were the experts, and they were going to do this highway, and there was this way of doing it, and that was the only way. So we had a lot of issues there. And of course, there was a bit of value difference there. The tribal people did a lot of circular thinking. All things were connected, where the highway was more or less stuck on linear thinking. You have a highway, you have a road, you get from point A to point B. Tribal thinking, humans are part of nature, the highway department is treating humans as separate from nature. The tribe spent a lot of aspects of the social and the cultural and spiritual aspects are very important in the project of the tribe, where the highway department is mainly looking at it from an intellectual, physical, and economic way. And then relationships are extremely important to tribal folks, where the highway department is mainly looking at the end product, this road. So the highway department, the most important thing to them is the road. They build roads to get through things. And the tribe, the most important thing was the landscape, and you should be building a road to fit the land. So fortunately, about 10 years later, as I said, in the fall of 1998, Montana Department of Transportation hired Skillings Connolly Incorporated, which was an outside firm, to come in and look at this problem. And they talked to the tribe, they talked to the highway departments, and they came up with a new way of designing roads. It was new back then. It's not new now, because this was back in the late 90s. But at the time, this was one of the first times they tried this road design, which is called context-sensitive design. And it was a way for them to try to undo this stalemate. And this is a new kind of planning defined as collaborative. Interdisciplinary approach that involves all stakeholders to develop a transportation facility that fits its physical setting and preserves scenic, aesthetic, historic, and environmental resources while maintaining safety and mobility. Yes. So, what they did is the Skillings Connolly ended up being the project managers. And they went out and they contacted about 600 stakeholders, did interviews, talked to them, tried to find out what was important to people, came back, got with the tribe, got with the highway department, and used this context-sensitive design to come up with a road that might be acceptable to both parties. And then the spring of 2000, the tribe hired Jones and Jones Architects, an architect, landscape architect, and also a planning firm from Seattle, Washington. And they wanted to have them come in and talk about landscape architecture. What were they going to do to beautify the highway? How are they going to make it look good? And how are they going to address the wildlife issues and also all the other environmental impacts? They asked them to come up with some mitigation measures. And so together, the tribe and J&J came up with several. They decided they're going to use natural materials like local quarry stone that would fit into the road bed, so it would look like alien type of materials that come in. They wanted to landscape the road to enhance the character of the towns. There's about seven towns on the reservation, and they got a nice facelift from this. And they also wanted to beautify the entrances to both sides of the reservation to make it inviting for people to come. They wanted to dodge and maintain the ponds and the lakes, keep the integrity and restore them that have been divided by the existing highway. These are two pictures of Mini PB. And you can see on the left that the highway is bisecting a fairly large lake there. And then on the right, this is more of 9-5. And you can see what a challenge that would be to try to fit the road into all of these wetlands. Also, they came up with a way of healing the scars from the road cuts and the blasting. Instead of leaving them very raw looking, they had a type of substance they could put on there that made it look like weathered rock. I don't know if you've seen that in some places. They're going to install interpretive name signs talking about horticultural and natural landscapes in two different languages, Salish, Kootenai, and English. And of course, we vegetate the area with indigenous plants, try to save as much of the trees as possible, and install wildlife crossing structures so the animals will go over or under the highway and maintain that animal movement and connect the habitats together. So finally, after all of this, in December of 2000, the three governments signed an agreement to do this. They had a design that they had talked to all the tribal members. They had a good context-sensitive engineering. They had a lot of mitigation factors worked out. They had areas where they could work on some of enhancing some of the natural resources. So this is a quote from Fred Matt, who was the tribal council chairman at the time. And he said, the words in the MOA, Memorandum of Understanding, are about rebuilding a road. But the process leading up to it was about listening to each other, building trust, honor, and mutual respect among the governments. And it wasn't until this happened that this project could actually move forward. So we're working on that together, designing it together, trying to come together and understand each other's values, trying to come up with a common vision for this road eventually led to success of actually implementing it. So they got it. The contractors came in and they got it, and the highway got it. That they got away from the notion of the road is the important thing. You've got to be mindful that there's a history to be respected, and now they have a road that's integrated with the ramp land rather than slicing through it to fit it with the landscape. So one of the big constructions, big one, was the wildlife crossing structures. This is a photo of the Banff. Anybody seen this? It's been on the Trans-Canada Highway. There's 24 different wildlife crossings on this highway, and the tribe and the highway departments went together to Canada to take a look at this to see how they could, in fact, design these. This is not a new thing to Montana. Actually, wildlife crossings have been around since like the 1950s, and they originated in the Netherlands and France, went to other countries, got into Canada, came to this country, and now in Montana. So Montana is not the first place to do this at all. The goals for the Highway 93 project for the wildlife was to restore habitat, create the corridors that I mentioned for all these migratory wildlife, conserve the species, and of course try to reduce the number of human vehicle collisions, which was a big one. So why was the People's Project unique? It was unique in the size and the scope of how they designed it. They put 42 wildlife crossings and 56 miles of highway. Nobody had ever done that before. That's a huge amount of wildlife crossings. So it was the scope and the size that made this unique, not necessarily that they were using the structures. And I listed some of them in there. They had quite a few of them. Probably the most impressive one was a 26-foot high, 54-feet wide, 20-foot-long tunnel that they put over by Ebro Hill. Lots of fencing, lots of wooden fencing, of course, to direct the wildlife. On the left, that's the big overpass that they built up by Ebro Hill. They built it in 2009 for $1.88 million. Total project cost for reconstructing the highway was about $121 million. And that's the finished product there at the bottom. So, did they work? Well, in December of 2008-2009, they started camera work and tracking surveys, and they documented that roughly 6,500 wildlife crossings are uses of the crossings. This is not individual animals, because they still don't have a good way of saying, this is one animal that went through, it could be one animal that went back and forth like 20 times for kids. So it's the actual number of crossings, not the actual number of animals. It's still pretty impressive. That's Christopher Campbell, who was a student in line at SKC. She's now a wildlife biologist with the tribe. But in 2008, this is what they counted as far as critters go, knowing that some of these might be double or even triple counting, but that's still a pretty good list. 3,600 white-tailed deer, black bear, grizzly, elk, moose, mule deer, 121 coyotes, and 255 miscellaneous species, and muskrats, skunks, raccoons, badgers, otters, beavers, mice, rabbits, wood rats, weasels, and they had birds, owls and pheasants and grouse that went through there. And they were concerned a little bit that maybe the predators would hang out in these culverts and pick out the prey as they went by, but the only one they saw evidence of that was for the owls. The owls would wait right inside there, wait for the mice to scurry by and go down and lay down. And then lots of reptiles and amphibians as well, although they would be building smaller crossings for these guys. And Whisper noticed that she would watch the wildlife, and she noticed that some of the deer, the does were actually training their fawns how to use the crossing. The does would actually go in some of the underpasses and lay down and let their fawns run back and forth through the culverts. And she assumed that they were just kind of training the babies how to use this thing. So she said that the behavior of the wildlife was really interesting to watch, especially she could always tell the first timers, especially if the car was going by overhead because it made noise. A couple others, coyote, the otters. I wouldn't want to meet them in the culvert. Lions coming and going. These are all from courtesy of the tribe. So, is this project going to be successful? Well, the Midwest Research Institute of Kansas City has predicted that over the next 20 years, the new road design will reduce fatal crashes by 70, injury crashes by 520, property damages by 650, for a total reduction of about 1,240 incidents, which is small feet considering it's a pretty dangerous highway. There is monitoring going on. The Montana State University Western Transportation Institute has started a five-year study, started in 2010, will go to 2015, and their study is looking at how effective are the wildlife crossings in reducing human vehicle collisions, how effective are they as providing corridors between the wildlife habitat, and then are they cost cost benefit to them. So what next? Well, there's another 17, 18 wildlife cross instructions online. You go into a little bit north of the reservation up there on Highway 93. They're going to add a lot of reptile amphibian crossings, which is near and dear to my heart because I should have been a herpetologist. I love those guys. On the bottom here, you can see somebody crawling through. Those little green things are frogs. And, you know, you've all heard of Snow Patrol, the band, right? What's the band on Rockland? It would totally be called Toe Patrol. And that could be Toe Patrol. That would be my rock band. And then US Highway 93 South, from Stevensville to Hamilton, a little farther, they're also looking at putting in similar structures in a 25-mile stretch. So, that basically concludes the story. It is deemed a success. It wouldn't have been a success without a lot of work and all the parties and building the trust and doing the collaboration and talking with people and understanding the values and the visions that all the different players had involved there. And as they do the monitoring, they'll find out how successful the wildlife structures are. The Montana Department of Transportation and the Federal Highway Department are using this particular project as a flagship study that they've written about in the publications and they've taken other places and used it as a model for around the world. So I'm just going to do my last slide. It's just some signs that I got. It's some wildlife crossing signs I found on the internet that I kind of liked, like this one. Warning, camels and kangaroos and wombats, next 92 kilometers. Obviously, that's Australia. This was a sign outside somebody's driveway. 10 miles per hour, bear, dog, kid, wolf, deer, rabbit crossing. This one must have come from Minnesota because where I lived up in Ely, there was a lot of car collisions and cars and noise. Well, and this is a sign from Japan warning people that please don't squish our frogs. So anyway, that's the end of my story here, and I hope any comments or any questions you might have.
Let's thank him. Please ask questions, and you can field your own questions as we go along.
Sure. So in order to get to that collaborative vision, what kind of process did they use? I mean, did they bring stakeholders together with the process, or did they just talk individually?
They did both. And the Stillings Conley company was the one that actually did the collaboration. And they did everything. They mostly did face-to-face. They did some focus groups. They did some individual interviews. And I believe they also did some phone interviews. But working with folks on the res, mainly face-to-face. It took them several, a couple of years. So they did like 600. I believe they did. I have not seen it. I have not seen the data of the tribe. I'm sure he has a copy of that. But I did not actually get a chance to look at that data.
I just wondered how the cost of the highlighting, the way that the collaborative process developed compared to what they expected to pay if you served on the traditional highlight.
That's okay.
Is there any discussion?
Yeah.
The
question was, what was the cost difference between doing it in the collaborative manner versus the traditional four-lane highway? And I haven't seen specific dollar-for-dollar amounts that did cost more money than the traditional highway did, because they brought in, they did more things that was, and especially the rerouting of some of the road. Instead of doing the straight shot like they were going to do, going around some of the wetland areas, taking out some of the windy places, actually add more to the design. So anytime you veer away from a straight regular engineered design, you do cost more, but I don't know how much more exactly. I'm going to guess it's probably a couple million.
And was there any debate about who should bear that cost? Or?
Well, oh yeah. But the Federal Highway Administration and the Montana Department of Transportation had money. Montana, for quite a while, was getting a lot of grants back in the 90s to upgrade their highways. And so they were going to do it. Malachi Water, and actually a lot of people in Bitterroot Valley didn't want a four-lane highway down there either, but they had the money, they did the EIS, they were going through with it pretty much no matter what. So a lot of it was federal and state, and the track came in some of the
law. How many lanes was the new highway?
Oh, excellent. The new highway, the interesting thing when they got done with this, is it stayed about, except for a 10-mile stretch, it still stayed a two-lane highway. But they widened the lanes, they widened the shoulders, they put in more passing lanes, more turning lanes, they restricted the access from some of the access roads that were coming in. They improved the line of sight, but from Polson to Monan, which is up by Flathead Lake, that 10-mile period, 10-mile stretch was the most heavily used traffic-wise. So they did put in a four-lane divided highway there. And then around the town of Arlee, which is about halfway up, they did split the highway two lanes on one side, two lanes on the other, and mainly that was to help beautify the town and encourage more tourism to the Arlee. It's actually pretty nice. The first time I went up there and saw it, I was like, wow, this looks really nice. So, yeah, so it's to stay mostly a two lane, except for the 10 mile stretch, which is not at all what the original plan was.
Has there been more non-tribal
Not really. Actually, there's been, I'd say, the most economic was probably the beautifying of the towns. People going in, the tribe helping people put new facelifts to some of the storefronts and things like that. But as far as opening up new shops, not really. Ravalli, which is the town right before you get to the Bison Range, had a little old sawmill in it and was kind of, I guess you'd call it run down, and some of the highway money helped really spruce up that little town. So most of it was kind of beautifying the town, but I don't have any new that have come in yet.
Are the tribes and the stakeholders happy with the outcome and design?
I think so. I think you noticed that when they signed the agreement, they were signing the agreement on the basic design and the environmental improvements, but there were still things they had disagreements on.
Did they include monitoring?
Yes, they were monitoring it.
Yeah. They included funding for that too?
Yes.
Cumulative impact, all that?
Yes, they included money for monitoring. And the tribe does have a natural resource shop that does that. As long as those Montana Department of Transportation and then the Montana Fish and Wildlife Parks and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are all involved with that as well, particularly as it relates to the wildlife operations.
Were there any other civil society, nonprofit, community-based groups that were stakeholders in the Champions Project? Or was it, assuming tribe being
or was it? Right. There aren't a lot of nonprofits on the reservation per se. There's a ton of them in Missoula. So the nonprofits were not huge stakeholders in this particular stretch of road. Now, when you're talking about going down to Highway 93 south of Missoula towards Hamilton, then yes, there'll be much bigger stakeholders, but not so much of the reservation.
And then the wildlife crossing, maybe I missed this, but was that something we tried brought to the table, or was that already in the plan of the project?
Well, part of the context of Sensitive Design was to look at wildlife migrations, but the tribe was the one that wanted to do the wildlife crossings particularly, and they're the ones that insisted on so many of them because of the migration and stuff. So, but they went together, and they did go to Canada, like I said, and looked at some of the existing structures so they could find out how to design them. But yeah, the tribe was the one that insisted on that.
You showed your slide on the two differences in the values between the tribe and the transportation folks. Tribes were spiritual, and it said end product for the other one. It didn't seem to me the way you described it, but what their value was on this was about safety.
It was safety, yep. And safety was very much in the mind. End product being the road itself.
It sounds like the whole
was safety, not safe. And of course, the tribe also wanted a safe road as well. I mean, they also wanted that, but they didn't want safety at the expense of all their other natural values. So yeah, safety was the number one. Safety and also capacity for being able to handle the increased traffic as the population of Montana increases. It is the main north-south highway through the entire state that takes all the way, it goes from the Idaho border all the way to Glacier and up to Canada. So it gets a lot of traffic. And that's expected to keep increasing. So the two-lane highway, as I mentioned before, when you didn't have many passing lanes, you just get clogged up for miles and miles. You're going 40 miles an hour, and that's when people would take chances and start passing. Yes?
What were some of the unresolved issues that you were just about to mention?
Some of the unresolved issues. I don't really know exactly what all the unresolved issues. I think that there was a lot of compromise. I don't think both sides got exactly what they wanted. The main concern to the tribe was the wildlife. Respecting, fitting the road to the landscape so that respected that their cultural how parts of the landscape and their sacred sites and all those that they were important to them. So it's mainly the design. But I'm not sure if there's any big unresolved issues. I haven't heard of any big unresolved issues. I just know that neither side got everything.
This may be an unfair question, so I apologize in advance, but given your experience living there and working at Sales Kootenai and being, you know, aware of what was going on at that time, how did this you know sort of event, how did that figure into the relations between the tribe and the federal government? You know, was this a kind of a bright spot of something that was really positive, or was it, you know, lots of other things that were going on that really weren't working out well? You know, in other words, you know, how did this in any way influence the more general, you know, relationship between the federal government and the tribe?
And again, I'm not an expert on the Sony, but I would say that it did definitely increase the trust and relationship with them. Down by Darby was a prayer tree, a ponderosa pine tree. Do you know about that? That's sacred to the tribes, and for years, MDOT wanted to cut it down because it was on a very windy part of the road, again, a very narrow part of 93, and that tree was in the way of what they wanted to do, and they kept threatening to wanted to cut it down. Of course, the tribe said absolutely not. It was a sacred tree. They said, it's just one tree. They said, it is not just one tree. It is a very sacred tree. And what happened was suddenly the tree died, like within a year, and it just turned all red needles and it died. And so there was a lot of speculation that the MDOT went out there and inoculated it with some disease and killed it, you know, because it's very fishy, that it would just also die in 1 year. And so the highway said, well, we're going to cut it down there. And the tribe said, no, it doesn't matter that it's dead. We're going to cut it down. So there was this lack of trust right there throughout. Montana Department of Transportation was not really known for its cultural sensitivity, you know, so there was a lot of mistrust there. But I think this project has helped immensely working with each other. They go, they present things together, and I think it has helped quite a bit. And I would call it more of a bright spot than not. I think that they worked out a lot of their differences. But remember, it was 10 years before they actually came to an agreement. And they had to bring in outside folks that actually understood both sides of the issues and help them see that. Because the tribe also had its position, and it's hard to get people off their positions, and so if they bring in these outside consultants, they were able to help do that.
Did MDOT learn their lesson and like change their way, put more wildlife crossing in?
They're very excited about this. As I said, they're using this as a flagship model to do other highways.
Yeah, the federal highway is thrown into.
And they are taking what they learned on the roads and they're putting it down to the rest of 93 off the reservation. So they get a lot of kudos, you know, it's a cap in their hat for doing all this as well. So they're actually fairly excited about it. They went into some of their journals and read up about, you know, oh yeah, this is a great project. They did take a little more credit than they probably do, but they were very excited about it. It was a new way of designing meadows.
Any other questions for Kim? Well, let's thank her again very much and thank you.